So if we're going to look at the transfer, which is advantageous to Enlight Construction, that'll be a good segue into the section by two. Where we left off on last Tuesday was talking about conjugation and conventual comments. What the conventual comments and conjugation were actually provided two things. Number one, there was a means of genetically mapping genetic loci in co-op. And number two, is also a window into the genetic structure of the chromosome of this organism. So the mechanisms or the methods that were used by Jacobin and Wallman was to use a blender to interrupt mating at different time points and then to score for inheritance of known markers as a function of the mating time. So obviously, as we talked about last week, what you need for experiments like this are recipient organisms with known genetic defects that can be complemented by transfer of markers from a wild type strain of E. coli that's a donor strain. And in these experiments, they use HFR donors. And you should all remember what HFR donors are from Meg Michael and also in our earlier discussion in the question. So what they did then was a time of entry experiment, which shows as you increase the amount of time in the mating mixture and you score for different markers, you start to see higher incidence of early transferred markers among the recombinants. And you start to see transfer and inheritance of later markers. So this showed then that the transfer was in a linear fashion, it wasn't just random, and that the markers can be related to one another in a specific fashion by measuring time of appearance of those markers in the recombinants. So that's the second part of what this really led to in terms of genetic discovery, was that you can use this type of an approach as a tool for mapping the locations of genes on the chromosome. And this is just an experiment that shows how those data are generated and how you interpret them. A time of entry experiment where you're looking at the inheritance of different genetic markers as a function of time of mating. Remember, these experiments are done where you interrupt the mating at different time points, shown down here on this axis, and then plate with the different markers and then plot the frequency and inheritance of those different markers among the transconjugates as a function of time. So you can see that the azide resistance is an early transferred marker. You get a high frequency of that occurring starting at 10 minutes and then reaching a plateau after about 20 minutes here. And then you see another marker, time resistance, which is resistance to a bacteria phage, T phage, which starts to appear shortly after the appearance of the azide resistance too. So this suggests that those two genetic markers are closely linked and among the early markers of transfer. The markers for utilization of lactose and galactose, on the other hand, are transferred later, and those are apart several minutes on the chromosome. So you can actually use this as a function of time to genetically map physical locations of genes. So the original genetic map for E. coli was a map that turned out to be a circular map, and I think you may see that next slide. The original map for E. coli was a circular map. The coordinates on the map were not map units based on physical distance, but were map units based on time. Because it was determined that in the HFR donor of E. coli, the entire chromosome could be transferred within 100 minutes. So it became a map that was based not on physical distance, but on a fourth dimension, if you will, which is time. The amount of time it takes from the origin of transfer to the appearance of these different markers is a direct correlation to their distance from each other on the physical genetic map. So the earlier maps for E. coli, and you'll see this also in references that you can look at, gave map locations by minutes. So you may talk about the lac operon being at minute 15 and the operon for galactose being at minute 24, or something like that. And those mapping distance were direct relations based on these time of entry experiments. So the time of entry experiments showed that the transfer is in a linear fashion from the fixed origin, okay? And you can use these experiments to map the distance and the relative position of any of these markers to each other on the chromosome. Also, as you saw from the previous slide, transconjugation frequency decreased with increasing distance from the origin of transfer. This type of an experiment is useful for localizing markers within a couple of minutes of each other. Now, another way of doing these experiments is the gradient of transfer experiment. It uses spontaneous breakage at a fixed time gradient. So in the interferometry experiment, we took samples at different time points and deliberately interrupted the mating and plated at those points. In a gradient of transfer experiment, you use a fixed period of time for mating and relying on just a spontaneous breakage of the mating pairs to give you the different gradients of transfer of the genetic markers. So in this experiment, you select for transfer of an early marker using HFRs whose direction of transfer is known, and also relative to the genetic map, we know which marker is going to be transferred early. You select for those earlier markers, and then you score among those recombinants for unselected markers. And I'll show you an example of this in just a minute. So you can then map unknown markers relative to when the transfer occurs between the known markers in the HFR transfer. And if you get a high recombination frequency between linked markers and an unknown marker, that suggests that these markers are close to each other on the genetic map. So this is, again, a circular map of E. coli. And again, it's given in map coordinates, which are expressed in minutes, not physical distances. So the zero point was arbitrarily chosen to be here at the 3-nanometer because one of the early HFRs that were characterized by John Parents and his colleagues transferred from this point on the chromosome. So that's why they determined this to be the zero point, because it was one of the early HFRs and transferred in this direction. Now, the convention looking at these arrows is that it indicates the direction of transfer, and what you need to do is imagine that, for example, the KL98 HFR has the arrow pointing in the clockwise direction. It transfers in the counterclockwise sense. So imagine that the arrowhead you can pull out of the map and then pull that forward. And what you will pull with that are all the genes back this way. So it transfers in the counterclockwise direction. Okay, so the arrow indicates that this is the beginning of the transfer, and it transfers genes from the back of the arrow. So pull that arrow out of the screen here and pull those genes through, which you'll see that early in transfer from KL98 is the NALA gene followed by this, KRC, D, etc. So it transfers in the counterclockwise direction. Does anyone see that? Okay. This slide also illustrates that there are a variety of different HFRs that have been isolated with origin of transfer at different places in the chromosome, as well as different directions of transfer. So the KL96, for example, or 191, transfers in the opposite orientation of KL98 and KL96. It transfers genes in the clockwise direction. Okay, so the first genes that we transfer here will be UBRC, followed by this, now, etc. So again, these experiments demonstrated that map of E. coli K12 is circular and not linear. So the mapping by gradient of transfer is also shown by this slide, which is in your text, showing that in this case, the origin of transfer here is this arrow, which is close to HIS, and transfers in order first the HIS genes at minute 44, and subsequently genes such as ARG at 90 minutes, the deletion of the lac operon and equivalent genes at 8 minutes, and then TRIP is transferred late. And that's shown by the arrow here, as I suggested on the previous slide, just pulling that arrow out of the screen and pulling these genes through, you see the order of transfer being this, ARG, and TRIP. So the mapping by gradient of transfer would then take an early transfer gene, which in this case, for this particular HFR, was the HIS gene. So you fix that at 100% of the recombinants because you're selecting for HIS plus. If you're selecting for HIS plus, then what you got are all HIS plus recombinants. So that's 100%. And then among those HIS plus recombinants, you start looking at how many of them have inherited this marker, your unknown marker, and then this marker. And you can then plot that as a function of distance on the genetic map because you know where HIS is, you know where ARG is, and you know where TRIP A is. And subsequently, you can then map the location of your unknown marker, in this case, it's RIP H, and see that that falls on this line very close to ARG. So in this case, what you're looking at is an HFR whose map location for the Archean transfer is known. You know the map location of RH and TRIP, and you're looking for where are these mutations which encode rifampin resistance map. And this is how you find it in the gradient of transfer experiment. And this is what some of the numbers would look like in this case of this type of a cross. Selecting for HIST again, and then looking for TRIP A recombinants. 1% of them also inherited TRIP, 7% inherited RGH, and 6% RIP. So if you remember from the circular map, which was the marker that was transferred latest after the H, the HIST was transferred? Because TRIP was way late. So that explains why it's inherited at a very, very low frequency. The orange gene was transferred a little bit earlier, and now it's inherited at a slightly higher frequency. Now, if you change the selected marker, and instead of looking at this G, which is an early transferred marker, and start looking at TRIP A, which is transferred late, then you're going to see numbers like this. Just about all of the markers that get transferred before this late marker are going to be inherited at about 30%, because they're going to go in earlier than this, because you're asking only for the recombinants which pick up TRIP A. So all of them have been transferred with at least this part of the genome transferred early, and then depending on the efficiency of recombination and where the crossovers are, you'll get about, on average, any of those preceding markers inherited at about 30%. Now what you can look at down here then, looking at again at a later transferred marker, you'll see once again that the early transferred marker, which is this G, transferred before RGH, is inherited about 30%. Again, because it's going in, you've already determined that all of these guys, who, since you selected for these, all of them will have picked up at least this part of the genome, and based on where the crossover of the recombination is going to occur, about 30% of the recombinants will inherit that marker. TRIP is transferred later than RGH, so again, it's going to be inherited at a lower frequency. Well, look at this. You got a jackpot here with your RIP block, 89%. So if you select for RGH, and 89% of the RGH transconjugates also pick up RIP, what does that suggest? Diane, you have a problem?
I just wanted to ask, so does that mean it goes RIP, HIS, RGH, TRIP?
No, because the origin of transfer is HIS. That's going in first. So you know that's transferred first.
Even though in HIS you get 28% of the time and the RIP 89% of the time?
Well, so that's the question I'm asking now. Since you're selecting for ARG, you know that all the ARG plus recombinants would have had the HIS marker transferred, because HIS goes in first. It goes in before ARG. But depending on where you're going to get your recombination, about 30% of your recombinant, of your this, of the ARG plus recombinants are going to get this as well. So that's a given for the preceding genes. The genes which are preceding the selected marker, they're going to be inherited about 30%. Now the question is, what about this marker which is inherited at a way higher frequency? Yeah?
It must be really close to the selected recombinant.
It's really close to?
To the RGH.
The RGH, exactly. So if you think about it, I'm going to direct your attention back here because I'm going to use it a little bit on. You think about it, what has to happen in HFR in order for markers to be transported and selected and stably inherited? Single strand of DNA is going in, right? So if your marker here is the ARG marker, as it's going to be stably inherited, what has to happen? It's got to recombine. Okay, so it's got to be a recombination at first. Right? And then recombination, crossover, and down. Right? So let's assume, for the sake of argument now, that you've got RH here and RIP is here. And you're getting co-inheritance of them at a relatively high frequency. Okay? How many different ways can you inherit the ARG marker? You can get crossovers here, right? You can get crossovers here. You can get crossovers here. The first step in the crossover, right? You can go here and then down, right? Okay, so the distance between these markers is going to dictate frequency of their inheritance, co-inheritance, plus genetic linkage. So the closer they are together, the less likely it is that the recombination, which is going to allow you to inherit RH8, is going to exclude RIF, because the space between the two isn't that big. So the shorter the distance between the two markers, the more likely they are to be co-inherited, thus the higher their proportion of linkage. The greater the distance between the two, the greater the space between the markers, the more likely it is for the recombination event that allows you to inherit ARG will occur between those two things. Everyone follow that? We're going to see that again when we talk about transduction. It's a similar concept. So that's why when you look at this and you see this number, you immediately say these two genes are very closely linked because they're co-inherited. They're coming in together and recombining in at a high frequency. Okay, one other concept which is really kind of interesting and intriguing that was very useful not only for conjugation genetics but also for trait genetics is the concept of zygotic induction. And this is intuitively obvious if you think about the biology of bacteriophage. And in fact, Jacobi Wallman used this concept of zygotic induction to tease out some of the aspects of bacteriophage landing genetics. So what they did was they transferred an HFR donor, they made an HFR donor with an F minus recipient, but the HFR donor in this case also contained a lambda prophage in the chromosome. So remember, we talked about bacteriophages, we talked about lysogenic phages and lytic phages, lambda being one that can be either lytic or lysogenic. This is the case where the lambda phage is integrated into the chromosome we call our HFR donor. So what happens when you do a conjugation with this type of a donor is that as the HFR donor donates its DNA to the recipient, when the prophage enters into the recipient strain, what's going to happen to the prophage? It's entering into a non-immune recipient. What do we mean by that? Think about phage genetics, and we'll talk about that in the later part of the hour, but I just want to see how much we can retain from this micro.
Recipient doesn't have any, or doesn't have infection with another phage that's similar.
That's the phenotype, but what makes it not immune?
It allows the phage to infect.
Right. So, why is it able to infect and go lytic in the cytoplasm of the recipient? What's missing? Think about the flip side. What makes it immune? We're asking why is it not immune? What makes it immune?
Touch with another
thing. Right. And so what's the molecular basis for immunity?
Depressant.
Right. Okay. So here you have lambda prophage in an HFR. And the reason why it's a prophage is because it's making a repressor. Right? So it can't go lytic. When the DNA of the prophage is transferred into the recipient, what's going to happen to the prophage? It goes lytic. The reason why it goes lytic is because there's no repressor in the recipient, right? There's no repressor there. The only reason why the prophage maintains its prophage state in the HFR donor is because it's making repressor protein. And repressor acts in what fashion? Cis, trans? It's transacting, right? It's a protein. It's floating around the cytoplasm. It goes on and represses. Comes off, goes on and represses. That's what keeps a prophage in prophage state. Once this DNA is transferred into a new E. coli by conjugation, it's in an environment where there's no repressor protein. So it can go lytic. And that's exactly what happens. That's what Jacobi and Wallman found, in that you can actually map then the transfer of this marker just by looking for infectious centers and looking for plaques.
Is the repressor encoded on the phage DNA or the...
It's encoded on the phage. The repressor gene itself is on the bacteria. Okay? So you wouldn't start to see synthesis of the repressor until the chromosome was transferred in and started synthesizing that protein. But in the meantime, there's nothing to keep it in the repressed state. So it goes on the other side. So this is a way that you can actually map the location of the prophage by looking directly for when you start losing transduction, when they start making plaques, rather than looking for a recombination. So this is what happens, just in a cartoon fashion. So you're looking at the transfer into a non-immune recipient, and the phage goes lytic. And if there's already a phage present in the recipient, you get no lysis because the resident phage would be making recurrences. Exactly. So if you had a mating of this type, you would not see lysis in the recipient when the phage, prophage was transferred. However, under these circumstances, you would see lysis in the recipient, and thus, if you did a time of mating experiment, you can map the relative location of the prophage insertion relative to the origin of transfer by seeing when you start getting lysis of the recipients, at what point in time during transfer. So that's the concept of zygotic induction. It is a way of directly measuring the location of the phage, and you don't need recombination as you do for inheriting markers such as the ARG marker or the RIP marker, and there's other HFR experiments, because all you need here is for the phage to go in and induce. You don't need any kind of recombination. And also, by doing these types of experiments, you can see that the frequency of zygotic induction is inversely related to the distance of the prophage site to the origin of transfer. So the further away it is from the origin of transfer, the less frequently you're going to see induction of the prophage because of the distance. So this is how you can also map the location of the prophage by zygotic induction. Okay, let's review very quickly then the nature of the transfer of machinery at the molecular level and genetic level, starting with the basic conjugated plasmid, the F-plasmid. It's a large structure of DNA, over 100 kilobases in size. It has an operon, which is a trioperon that encodes all the genes for transfer of the DNA, including specifically the F helix genes. And this operon is about 35 kilobases long, has 25 genes in it, a very large structure. The plasmid also contains two important origins. One is the origin of transport, or the T. This is the point at which the nick is made in the DNA that generates a single strand for transfer. And then the plasmid also has the standard ORIV for vegetative replication of the DNA in the plasmid. And that's just the replication for the plasmid. Also on the F plasmid, there are multiple insertion sequence elements, and this provides mobile sites of homology for it to recombine with the chromosome of E. coli, and that's how HFRs are generated. And this shows the structure of the plasmid itself. So here's your trioperon. Again, it has principally the genes for the F helix. It also has genes for regulation of transfer. It has genes for stabilization of the mating pairs, surface exclusion so that F plus donor strains don't mate with each other. Other structures here, such as the IS elements I mentioned earlier. You do have also the origin of transfer and the origin of vegetative replication, so that the plasmid can replicate on its own. So the transfer genes also include transacting proteins which are responsible for replication of the DNA and transfer of the DNA. So this includes a relaxase that relaxes the DNA and a primase which primes the replication functions which are involved in transfer of the DNA. You also have genes that are involved in the mating pair formation, to include the pilus genes. And again, don't think of the pilus as a channel through which the DNA is transferred. The pilus primarily acts to get the mating pairs initially in contact with each other and then draw them together so that you have formation of the channel and coupling of the two bacteria so that the transfer of the DNA can occur. So these are also transacting proteins, and you have a cis-acting site, which is, again, the origin of transfer, the site at which the DNA will be nicked for transfer of the DNA to the recipient. So the initial step, then, is contact between donor and recipient. Pilus retracts to bring the two bacteria together in a functional mating pair. Then the relaxase is a nuclease. It's an enzyme which generates the single-stranded nick at ORIT. And the reason why it does this is because DNA transfer by HFR using the F fertility function is a single strand transfer. So you make a nick in a chromosome at ORIT, and this is again a structure of an HFR. So that F plasmid I showed you in the previous slide is integrated down and the chromosome. So you get a, a nick at 40T and exposes a 5' and 3' end, and it's the 5' end which is going to be the leading end that transfers into the recipient during conjugation. That's what's shown here. So the 5' end is the strand which gets transferred in. And during this transfer process, since the transfer process in an HFR is a conservative mechanism of DNA transfer, you start getting replication of the strand that's being transferred. You get a replication of the complement of that so that you don't lose anything in the donor. So as the strand peels out, it exposes a template strand on which you can now, or which the HFR now replicates so that it fills in and replaces the DNA strand which is being transferred. So the donor never loses any DNA. Okay? That's why you see here as the strand rolls out, it exposes a single strand template upon which the DNA polymerases can now replicate the strand that's being transferred so that the donor doesn't lose anything. The single strand that's transferred into the recipient now can act through a strand invasion at the homologous regions in the chromosome of the recipient so that you get inheritance of the transferred DNA in the recipient. And this follows a similar cycle of homologous recombination that Ann talked about on Tuesday in her recombination lecture. So the conjugation is very efficient. You can get up to 100% of the F minus recipients in the population to be conjugated with an HFR donor. It's tightly regulated. You can isolate strains which are highly efficient at transferring the DNA and some which are repressed for the DNA transfer. I mentioned that it was conservative that the DNA is lost from the donor during HFR transfer because the donor DNA is replicated and that transferred strand is replaced during the process of DNA transfer. And another thing which is important, which is a relatively new concept over the last 10 or so years, is that transfer in conjugation is not just a DNA transfer event. And in particular, if you look at what's been studied and described in the type 4 secretion systems, you can see that not only is DNA transfer, but protein is transferred as well. So the type 4 transfer system is shown here in this example, and we'll talk about it a little bit more in detail. We'll talk about secretion systems. This is the secretion system which actually transferred DNA across kingdom barriers. And this is the case of Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which is a bacteria pathogen of plants, which causes tumors in plants. And the way that it does this is by transferring a plasmid from the bacteria into the plant cell. And DNA on that plasmid goes directly to the chromosome, to the nucleus of the plant cell, and generates tumors of the plant as a result of that. So this is a tumorigenic bacteria that preys on plants. And the mechanism is a mechanism of transfer, which involves not just DNA, but also protein. So the DNA is a plasmid, which is called the T-plasmid. That's why it's called the cDNA here, which is transferred through this secretion structure. So it's a structure of multiple proteins which traverse the inner and outer membranes of this gram-negative organism and form a structure which acts as a needle to communicate directly through the cell wall of the plant and transfers the DNA through this structure into the plant cytoplasm. And at the leading edge of the 5' end of this cDNA is a protein, which allows the DNA to target directly to the nucleus of the plant cell. So in this particular system, we described it as a system of DNA transfer and protein transfer. And it turns out that in the other conjugation systems that we talked about, such as the HFR system, those also are examples of where there are proteins that are associated with the transfer of DNA. So I think we've come to a point where we can't just think of conjugation or DNA transfer by cell-to-cell contact as being exclusively transfer of DNA. It often involves transfer of proteins which are attached to that DNA. In this case, the DNA protein, the protein associated with DNA, is used for targeting that DNA to another site within the recipient. In this case, it's the nucleus of the plant cell. In other cases,
The protein associated with the DNA may be involved in replicating that DNA in the host. So then there'd be kinases which are associated with the DNA when you transfer. So this sort of rounds out the whole story about conjugation and gives me to think of it as a macromolecular system of transfer that transfers large macromolecules as to the DNA as well as protein. Now let's briefly talk about the case of plasmids. Now plasmids, such as gas plasmids, are autonomous. They can certainly transfer themselves through machinery, which is very similar to what we saw in the integrated form in the HFR. But there are also examples of plasmids which themselves are not able to transfer, but which contain genetic structures which allow them to be mobilized and transferred by other plasmids that they themselves are conjugated. So a plasmid in this case, in shown here in black, cannot transfer itself. But in the presence of another transferable plasmid, such as the F plasmid, it can then mobilize transfer of this non-conjugated plasmid, which is in black. And the way that works is that there are structures on this plasmid which include a similar structure to the origin of transfer that's found on the conjugated plasmid, the F plasmid. So that transacting enzymes from the conjugated plasmid can act on those homologous structures from the non-conjugated plasmid and mobilize that plasmid into a recipient strand. So if it has the ORT, then the enzymes, such as the relaxase from the F plasmid, can recognize the structure on the smaller non-conjugated plasmid and start driving transfer of the smaller plasmid into a recipient. So it's a transacting system of complementation, if you will, where the proteins that are produced by the conjugated plasmid can be used to mobilize the plasmid, which in and of itself alone is not capable of conjugation. So this is the concept of mobilization of plasmids. And you can also make mutants in the F plasmid so that it is capable of mobilizing a plasmid, but it itself can't mobilize, can't move, and can't conjugate. So you can do transfers where effectively you can transfer the non-mobilizable plasmid, but maintain the F plasmid alone in the donor without the F plasmid being transferred. So if you think through the genetics of how this might work, what kinds of mutants you might need in order to make that happen, you can eventually figure out how you can allow transfer of a mobilizable plasmid without transfer of the donor plasmids. Yeah.
Under like without a mutation,
you
will both be transferred.
Exactly. Under normal circumstances, both can be transferred. So you can think about it as a way that this non-conjugated but mobilizable plasmid piggybacks on the ability of the conjugated plasmid to transfer itself from cell to cell. Okay, let's move into from conjugation to transduction. And transduction is gene transfer by bacteriophages. It was first described in Salmonella with P22, and then subsequently P1 was found in E. coli to be the phase of transducing bacteriophage in E. coli. So the mechanism is that this is a mistake on the part of the phage. The generalized transducing particles are particles of phage that have random fragments of DNA from the host bacterium packaged into the phage heads. So the way that you generate generalized transducing lysates is by growing up the phage in a host, and as the phage make more phage particles and start packaging DNA into the phage heads, they make mistakes, and some of those mistakes lead to random packaging of host DNA from the bacteria into the phage heads. And the random packaging is dictated by the position of what we call pack sites, which are packaging sites that are recognized by the enzymes of the phage to start packaging their own DNA into the phage cells. And since these are sites of DNA sequence, one can easily imagine that there may be similar looking sites, homologous sites, on the bacterial DNA that may be recognized by the phage enzymes at a low frequency. And that, in fact, is what happens. It leads to packaging of these bacterial DNA fragments into the phage heads as opposed to the correct bacteriophage DNA being packaged. So in terms of what the capabilities are for generalized transduction, it's dictated, not surprisingly, by the size of the phage head. So P1
can package between 91 and 100 kilobases of DNA. The normal size of the P1 phage DNA is about 100 kb, so the phage head contains up to 100 kb of DNA. Similarly, for P22, which infects Salmonella, the phage can package up to 44 kb of DNA because of the head size is the right size for the phage DNA, which is on the order of about 40 kb or so. So for a generalized translucent lysate, mistakes happen, and for P1, about 1% of the phage particles in a lysate will be generalized translucent phage particles. So for the most part, 99% of the time, the phage get it right. They put phage DNA in the phage heads, and about 1% of the time, bacterial host DNA is impacted by mistake. P22 makes the mistakes a little bit more frequently, and in fact, you can get mutants of P22, which can bump up the frequency of these mistakes happening to about 2% or slightly larger than 2%. Experiments in E. coli showed that just about any marker on the E. coli chromosome can be transduced by P1 at a relatively high frequency. 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 is a pretty good frequency for transduction. And this also reinforces the point I made earlier that transduction is random. You can get random transfer of these DNA markers. And the frequency of inheritance of any of these given markers is going to be based on, obviously, how efficiently those particular fragments that contain those markers can be packaged into the different molecules. And we can assume, for the most part, that it's random, so the efficiency is going to be about the same for any given marker. And also, the efficiency of stable integration of that transduced DNA into the recipient will dictate the efficient frequency that can inherit those markers. And this is going to be based on recombination. And again, for any given marker anywhere in the chromosome, recombination frequency is going to be about the same. So for transduction, as for HFR transfer by conjugation, recombination is required for stable inheritance of the transferred DNA from the donor to the recipient. Keep in mind the donor in this case is long dead, right? The phage is only a vehicle for the donation of the DNA. The donor is that E. coli on which you make the phage lysate. And in doing so, you kill the phage, you kill the donor. So how can this be used for mapping? This technique is used for mapping, it's also used for strain construction. But for mapping, it gets back to some concept we talked about earlier when we talked about conjugation with HFRs. You can map the location of genes by the co-inheritance frequency of two markers. So markers A and B, the frequency that these two markers, these two genetic markers will be inherited is going to be dependent on two things. Number one, the probability that both A and B are going to be packaged on the same translucent fragment. That's a given, right? They've got to be on the same fragment, otherwise you're not going to be able to inherit them in the same recombinant. And the probability that A and B will both recombine into the recipient chromosome. The two factors that both depend on distance. Actually, that's perfect. And if you think about it, this last point makes sense. There's an inverse correlation between the distance between the markers and the co-translation frequency. So the closer the markers are together, the higher the frequency is going to be. The further apart they are, the lower the co-transduction frequency is going to be. And this is the co-transduction frequency equation that you can use to actually measure the distance between markers. So if we want to take a look at, again, how this all plays out in terms of the molecules themselves, keep in mind that what's necessary for A and B to be co-inherited is the relative distance between each other and whether they can be put together on the same fragment in the translucent particle. So if the distance between A and B exceeds, let's say, 9 kilobases, what are the chances that you're going to be able to get these co-inherited in a transduction in E. coli within a P1? Mrs. Lightfoot?
You want to accept 91 to 100?
Uh-huh.
Now we're going to be getting the close to the other one.
Okay, so it's going to be very, very rare. So what are the chances of packaging something exactly like this when you've got 90 cold bases in between where you can get the bricks? Okay, so yes, it's going to package 90 or 100 kV, but what are the chances of getting exactly that much distance in that one big part as opposed to having a break between A and B? So the chances are going to be much lower for A and B to be packaged from the same project if they're that distance apart. If they're 40 kV apart, have much more in your favor now. Because you're closer together, to break between the two, going to be less likely than if they're 90 kV apart. Similarly, when you're looking at recombination, and again, we'll take a look at our E-coli chromosomes. To inherit both of these markers, what has to occur? Base here, bigger transducing pattern. You need two crossovers, right? Going to be a single strand of DNA is going to cross over into the chromosome. Homologous recombination. So the first crossover can occur, take a look and brought your lines again, can occur here and back down. Both markers inherited? Yes, okay? So if we're selecting for A, the first crossover can occur anywhere down this way, okay? Doesn't have to be here, it can be over here, off the board. Right? Further over it is, what's the likelihood that the second crossover is going to be here or here? Okay? Depends on the distance between A and B now. So the first crossover is here, second crossover that you're selecting for A could be anywhere here. So you still have A, right? It could also be here. So if you're looking for the co-inheritance of A and B, you're looking for the recombination. And the bigger the distance between A and B, the less frequently you're going to be able to get the right crossover that's going to be your B. So the closer you put A and B together, the less likely you're going to have another crossover between those two to separate them. So you get a higher cross transduction frequency. The further apart these two genes are, the higher the likelihood that that second crossover is going to occur between them. And that's going to drop your third transduction frequency. So that's why this formula expresses that concept in a mathematical fashion so that you can understand. And if you think about it through, you know, in this fashion, it does make sense. You've got to get both markers on the same transducing fragment, and the recombination has to occur to the left and to the right so that both markers are included. If that recombination or crossover step occurs between the markers are separated and then not co-inherited.
Is the transducing fragment from the chromosome or is it from a plasmid?
This is chromosome.
Okay, so chromosome you can't really control where A and B are on the chromosome.
Well, A and B are fixed on the chromosome, so, right? So if you're looking at mapping A relative to B or vice versa, then that's where they're going to be fixed. They're not going to be moved, right?
Whereas plasmid, you can control it. You just put the chains on the plasmid.
When you're cloning and you're in the right, exactly. So this is what it looks like when you measure it by using that formula. And in fact, experimentally, the curve is almost identical. So if you're mapping the distance between markers relative to co-transduction frequency, you get a curve like this. And you can see it's inversely related to the map distance between markers. So you get a high frequency of co-transduction of markers when the markers are close together. And this drops off the further apart the markers get. That's all that that equation showed you in the previous slide. You don't need to memorize the equation. It just gives you the concepts in a mathematical format so that you can try to understand that a little bit better. But again, I think intuitively, if you imagine what the requirements are for co-inheritance to occur, it makes sense, even if you don't have that mathematical formula. So what does happen to the donor DNA during transduction? Well, it goes in, and as I said, you have to have recombination for the stable inheritance of the donor DNA. If the donor DNA doesn't recombine, you get what we call abortive transduction. We talked about that in the night. Now, what happens in the case of plasmid DNA? Can phage, that are translucent phage, also package plasmid DNA? And the answer is yes, they can. So they can package a plasmid DNA as well. And when the plasmid DNA is injected into the host cell, the recipient cell, that plasmid can replicate on its own. So it doesn't require recombination for its stable inheritance. It replicates on its own. Similarly, in that phage lysate, so I said only about 1 or 2% of the lysate contains translucent particles, what happens if your recipient is actually infected with one of those other particles, which is actually real phage? Well, the answer is simple. They die. Those recipients die. So in a transduction experiment, what you'll end up with are survivors that have survived the phage infection because they've been infected with translucent particles. So you'll deal with numbers here as well. Obviously, you're not going to really want to use a lot of phage to infect or a high multiplicity of infection because you're going to end up killing most of your recipients. Because remember, it's not a pure population of translucent particles. It's only like 1 to 2% actually are capable of transduction. The others are real live phage that can kill recipients. So let's talk about an example of a sample three-factor cross that you can use for mapping the distance of genes and markers in a recipient by using transduction. So let's take for this experiment, two strains of bacteria, the donor, which is wild type, has the ARG and RPOB alleles. Remember, the RPOB is the allele for ribosomal, no, RNA. RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase. So rifampin resistance maps to this allele, RPOB. Pi A is marked by a transposable element. This encodes tetracycline resistance. So it's mutant at this allele, but it's tetracycline resistant. That's what we're going to describe right here. The recipient is mutant at the ARG locus, it's RIF resistant, and it's wild type at Pi A. So we can select then for either TET resistance, we can select TET resistance, right? Donor to recipient, or we can select for ARG plus, because the donor is ARG plus, the recipient is ARG minus. We can do that selection on minimal medium for that argument, right? So here are the types of crossovers that you would get in a transduction experiment with donor shown here and your recipient shown here, if you're selecting for tetracycline resistance. So again, the simple thing to look for here is where can you get crossovers that will give you recombinants that are TET resistant. That's what we're selecting for here. So here is the chromosome of the recipient. In order to get TET resistance, you can get the first crossover to the left of the marker and the second crossover to the right, and you'll get this. It'll be the same markers as in the original recipient, ARG minus, RIF resistant, and TET resistant. So you'll get transductance like this if the crossover occurs immediately to the left and the right of the transposon. You can also get a crossover that occurs between ARGE and RPOB, right? This will still give you TET resistance, won't it? First crossover is just a little bit further to the left. We didn't move the second crossover at all. So in this case, what you'll get among the TET-resistant transductants are some that are now RIF-sensitive because the donor was RIF-sensitive. Remember, it was the wild-type allele for RPOB, not the resistant one. Similarly, if the first crossover was to the left of ARG-E, these transductants will have inherited both the ARG wild-type marker and the wild-type RPOB gene, making the recipient ARG plus and RIF sensitive, as well as TET resistant. And then this shown down here is what is going to be a relatively rare event because it involves four crossovers, not two. So this particular phenotype is going to be relatively rare because of the number of crossovers that are required. So if you think out the different crossovers that you can get in the transduction to yield TET-resistant transductants, this is the kind of sketch you're going to make. So let's say we transduce and we select protect recycling resistance, and we want to score for those unselected markers where I just showed you on the previous slide. We can now measure the map distances by co-transduction frequency. So the co-transduction frequency is determined by looking at a selected marker. In this case, we're looking at 100 tet-resistant strains. And then we're going to look at unselected markers. Of those tet-resistance mutants, how many of them are R+, how many of them are RIF-sensitive? Remember, these are the other two markers that are on the donor strain. And this is the phenotype of the different colonies that you get and the numbers of them. So you can look at and say, okay, of the set cycle resistant mutants, how many of them were R+? Thus, we're looking at the linkage between RGE and Thi A, which is marked by the tetracycline resistance transposon. And the arrow in this direction goes from the unselected marker to the selected marker. And how do we arrive at this number? We're looking at the number of R+ transductants among the tet-resistant transductants. And that is 44. 44 out of 100, frequency is 0.44. So how do we get this number? The 0.84, showing us the linkage between RPOB and tet-resistance. Where does that come from? Remember, the selected marker is tet-resistance. The unselected marker is RIF sensitivity.
So you're just adding together the two?
Which two?
The two that are most sensitive, the RH negative most sensitive, there's 40, and the RH positive, there's 44.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the sensitive, RIF sensitive transductance among those tet resistant transductance. So you're adding 40 plus the 44. That's 84 out of 100. That gives us a frequency of 0.84. And if you look at this and you say, well, you know, the distance is inversely correlated to the co-transduction frequency, bingo, that's exactly what you have here. So the closer the genes are to each other, the higher the co-transduction frequency. The further apart, the lower the frequency. That's exactly what you predict, and that's what you get from that.
Are these figures in the genetics book?
No, this is in the Miller manual that was in the first set of references.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you're looking at it, you're basing it on the wild.
Basing it on what the donor is giving to the recipient.
Right, okay, the donor.
Yeah. So remember, in that initial structure that I showed you, the donor phenotype, the donor genotype, was wild type at the ARDS locus, wild type at the RPOB locus, so RIF sensitive and pet resistant. So we're looking at what gets transferred from the donor and inherited from the recipient. And you can do a similar type of calculation looking at ARDS plus as a selected marker and that resistance to a RIF sensitivity is unselected markers. So you guys can work through that on your own. All right, let's move on to the next topic, which is the bacteriophage genetics topic. I'm sure we cover all this material. The bacteriophage are important because bacteriophages were really present at the beginning of molecular biology. The early molecular biologists, really the founders of the field, guys like Salvador Luria and Max Delbrück, they were physicists who decided that they could understand more about the important things in biology by applying their skills in physics and looking at biological systems at the molecular level. They were the ones who really brought in the discipline and the quantitative discipline and approach to bacteriology that created this field of molecular biology today. And some of the early experiments which really marked the birth of molecular biology involved bacteriophages, such as the Hershey-Chase experiment. Anybody know what that was?
Discovered DNA was actually the molecule that had genetic information.
Exactly. How did they do it?
They labeled DNA and they labeled protein on the bacteriophage,
uh-huh.
And they injected it into bacteria. And when they lysed it, they looked to see, they looked to see where they could see the label.
Okay, what label did they see?
They saw the phosphorus ring on the DNA.
Exactly, right. So the Hershey-Chase experiment was one of the experiments which helped to secure the place of DNA as the information of genetic information, as opposed to protein.
Because remember, the early part of the 20th century, as late as the mid-50s, there are still people who thought the DNA was too dumb a molecule to be able to encode the vast variety of life forms that exist in the world, in nature. It had to be protein, because protein was much more flexible. I mean, after all, there are 20 natural amino acids, plus an abundance of unnatural amino acids, and only four bases in DNA. So how could DNA do it? Well, the Hershey-Chase experiment was one of the experiments, in addition to Watson and Crick's determination of the crystal structure of DNA, which helped to bring down the protein hypothesis and reinforce the idea of DNA as being the genetic information. The Campbell model of recombination, site-specific recombination of late phase lambda into the chromosome as it goes into a prophase state, really serves and continues to serve as a model for oncogenic phages, oncogenic viruses, as we call them, and in cancer biology. So this is really at the heart of molecular biology and has led to a lot of advances in tumor virology as well. And the original discovery of restriction enzymes owes its origins to studying bacteriophages and how bacteriophages restrict host DNA and vice versa. So some of these things we talked about in that micro, I don't think I need to go into any detail about phages or their structures or talk about the different properties. Suffice it to say that these are organisms which are self-contained in terms of, well, not self-contained, these are absolute parasites. They require a host for replication. They have no ribosomes or enzymes for protein synthesis. They replicate by synthesis and assembly. So they replicate DNA, they synthesize proteins to put their phage particles together, and then these are assembled at the end of the cycle. And unlike bacteria, they don't divide by binary fission. They divide and replicate by this fashion. So what you get at the end of an infectious cycle is a burst of phage particles. So it's not the exponential type of growth that we see with bacteria, which goes from one bacterium dividing into two, and then two daughter cells becoming four. It's a burst of production of bacterial phages. And phages have different types of morphology, as we've seen before. Those are the phages. The T phages look like a classic head with tail and fiber to interact with the host cell. You have filamentous phages, which are these long phage particles that have DNA, generally single-stranded DNA. So some of these are used in molecular biology techniques for generating substrates for doing sequencing or for cloning for phage expression or phage display. Some of these filamentous phages are released from the cell, not by lysis, but by extrusion through the membranes. So there really are a variety of different phage types in nature. And for just about every bacterium that has been described, you can find bacteriophages that live on them. So if you look hard enough, you'll find phages, because that's just the nature of the jungle out there. You have organisms that live on and parasitize other organisms. So what I'd like to focus on is to go over very briefly again the concept of the phage life cycle in a lytic stage, but also spend some time talking about lysogeny and using bacteriophage lambda as a model for lysogeny to understand how a phage can both be lytic and infect the host and kill the host, as well as lysogenic, where it essentially parasitizes the host without killing it, and continues to be propagated in the culture of the bacteria because it is part of the bacterial chromosome. And that's the lysogenic or prophage state of the bacteria, in the bacteriophage. So the bacteriophage life cycle, or multiplication cycle, is a very straightforward but regulated cycle of events. The first step is attachment of the phage particle to a sensitive host, injection of DNA into the host, and then synthesis of what we call early gene. So the synthesis of early messenger RNA and protein. And some of the early phage proteins will be necessary for taking over the cell. So some of the T phages will have promoters for the early genes, which depend on host RNA polymerases for transcription of the early proteins. Some of these early proteins then will be dedicated to destroying the host DNA,
And some of those early proteins will actually synthesize new polymerases, phage-specific polymerases, which will drive expression of the middle and late phage genes. So this is a way that the phage can completely take over the host and shift all of the host's macromolecular synthetic machinery in favor of the phage by killing the host's DNA, so it's no longer making message, but at the same time having polymerases now which will dictate the synthesis of message, which are phage-specific messages that can be translated by the existing autosomal protein translation machinery of the host. Similarly, some of those middle genes will be polymerases to replicate the phage genomes. And as it replicates the phage genome, what you get is an amplification effect. So you get more phage proteins being made, more of the polymerases, more template, until you get to a point where the late genes, which are now being transcribed and translated, are assembled into the proteins that form the head and tail particles, and then you start getting packaging of the pre-synthesized phage genomes of the DNA into the phage heads. And then some of the late genes which are synthesized in certain stages actually will lead to lysis of the host and release of the bacteria. So the first step then, the entry step, involves specific proteins on the phage attachment proteins. You can think of it as those structures on the tail. These interact with a specific structure in the bacteria, which is a phage receptor protein. Keep in mind that the receptor proteins are proteins that the bacteria make anyway. They have been adapted, or the phages have evolved to recognize these structures so that they now can affect these bacteria. So the bacteria aren't making these proteins that the phage can use as portals for entry just because they want to get affected by phages. These proteins are proteins such as transporters for the bacteria to take up substrates. So the receptor for bacteriophage landing, E. coli, is the molecule is used for transporting maltose and maltodextrin into the bacteria so that we can use that as a carbon source. So the phage have evolved to recognize these pre-existing structures on the bacteria so that they're not going to be an entrance to the bacteria. The absence of the phage receptor, the absence of these structures, means that those bacteria will be resistant to infection. So there is definitely a restricted host range for these phages. So phages which will affect E. coli won't necessarily infect Salmonella and vice versa because they require specific structures for the receptor. So the first step then, the entry steps, is shown here, and this electron micrograph I think shows very nicely that you have the complete phage shown here, the head and the tail, but also in different phage structures may have phage particles that don't contain any DNA at all. So this particular phage here, which shows an empty head, it's optically translucent here in the electron micrograph, it's an empty phage, so it didn't get any DNA capsulation. So you do get in lysates some defective particles which can attack, but have nothing to donate. So they can stick to the phage receptor in the bacterium, but can't inject any DNA because they have no DNA. This shows again the interaction of the phage with the outer membrane structure. And this just shows it in a different slice through the bacteria. So the phage genes themselves are generally organized in a fashion that will allow them to be sequentially expressed in a very time-specific fashion. So this is the genome for phage T7, showing you the early genes which are expressed. The middle genes are the genes for DNA replication. And the late genes are going to be the genes which are dedicated toward making the phage particles, which then will allow assembly and packaging of the DNA, which gets created by the middle phase. This also shows that for T7, for example, there is a early expressed gene in this region here, which is the RNA polymerase. This is that specific, the phage-specific RNA polymerase I talked about earlier. So as the phage is injected, the phage DNA is injected into the host, these early genes are going to be transcribed by host RNA polymerase. They will make proteins that will start attacking the host DNA, but also proteins which will now allow the page to transcribe its middle and late keys, and that's done by the T7 specific on the components. So it's a very tightly regulated and sequential series of its gene expression going through the early, middle, and late keys. Now the T7 polymerase is important not just for phage biology, but because many of you will actually use it in some of your cloning experiments. So a typical vector for cloning of genes that you'd like to get expressed at a high level is the so-called PET vector. And this is a vector that allows you to regulate expression of the cloned gene that you're interested in. So sometimes when you clone a gene and you'd like to get large quantities of that gene product made, making that gene product may not be good for the bacteria. It may kill the bacteria. It may be toxic to the bacteria. There may be a lot of reasons why you don't want to turn on expression of the cloned gene until you get to a certain point in the culture where you'd like to make all that protein at once. So this particular PET vector allows you to regulate expression of the cloned gene. And the way this works is that you clone your gene without a promoter into this vector behind a T7 promoter. So the T7 promoter comes directly from the T phage, the T7 phage, and its transcription is regulated by T7 RNA polymerase. So under normal circumstances, in the absence of T7 RNA polymerase, your target gene is not going to be expressed. It's not going to be transcribed because it's dependent on a promoter that is recognized only by the T7 RNA polymerase. So that gives you your regulated expression. In your E. coli background, this gene won't be expressed. So how do you get it expressed? The E. coli strand that is used for expression of these PET vectors is a strain that's generally called a DE3 or DE3 derivative strain. And the important part about this strain is that it encodes the gene for the T7 RNA polymerase, which is gene 1 in T7. And its expression is regulated by the lac promoter. So it's a second layer of gene regulation. So under these conditions where your PET vector is in this strain background, the target gene is not going to be expressed because the T7 RNA polymerase is not being made because its synthesis or its transcription is dependent upon an inducible lac promoter. So in this background, the lac I gene encodes the lac repressor, which keeps this promoter turned off. When you add IPTG to this system, remember IPTG is an inducer of the lac alkaline. And the way it induces it is it displaces the lac repressor. So this is an IPTG inducible expression system. When you add IPTG, the lac repressor is displaced from this promoter. The promoter is now recognized by RNA polymerase, E. coli RNA polymerase. And it transcribes, and you get synthesis of the T7 gene 1 product, which is T7 RNA polymerase. And that T7 RNA polymerase can now recognize the T7 promoter, which is driving expression of the target gene. And that's how the system works. So if you're talking about cloning into a T7 dependent expression vector, like a PET vector, this is the molecular basis for how the regulated expression of your target gene works. It's dependent upon that RNA polymerase from T7. So let's talk a little bit about how phages replicate. And I think this is instructive because it helps you to understand a little bit more about DNA replication as well as phage lifestyle. Keep in mind, there are a lot of different kinds of phages, and by extension, there are different structures of your DNA. So let's talk about the replication of circular, single-stranded DNA, such as phage M30C. So how do you replicate a circular molecule? How do you replicate a circular molecule which is single-stranded? Well, the first step is you have an RNA primer. And E. coli makes the RNA primers for the phage. You need RNA primers to prime synthesis of the chromosome, so the phage will use some of those RNA primers to prime synthesis of the negative strand from the phage. So M13 is what we call a positive-stranded phage, because the phage DNA itself is the positive strand. In the E. coli host, you get replication of the negative strand using the host E. coli RNA polymerase, which will replicate the negative strand using the positive strand template. And as happens in E. coli DNA replication, the RNA primer is going to be removed by exonuclease, and you get depletion of the circuit. So that's the first step. What you've generated here is what we call an RHEC, or a replicated form. It's now a double-stranded molecule of phage M13. The next step is the shifting of the RF to a rolling circle type of replication. What happens here is that there is a nick that is generated in the positive strand of the phage double circle now, a double-stranded circle, so that you get the generation of rolling circle replication. That's shown by the arrow extending in this direction. As it displaces the positive strand, it replicates the positive strand on the negative strand template. So it's rolling circle replication. And that's what you see. It continues around here, and then you're completely replicating now a copy of the positive strand on this double stranded template and generated another copy of positive strand. And this can also go into negative strand synthesis to make more RFs, or replicated proteins. So it just repeats the process here. So what you have basically is a way of amplifying templates to generate more copies of the phage DNA. But ultimately what the phage wants is not a double-stranded circle, it wants a single-stranded circle. Yes? You're stretching? Is it getting too boring for you? So what the phage wants is a single-stranded circle. So in this replicated form now, the rolling circle replication, at some point in time, you'll get generation of DNA binding proteins, shown here as the gene byproduct, which when you start generating the single strand coming off during single strand during the rolling circle replication, the single strand binding protein will bind to that single strand that peels off during the rolling circle replication. And this will drive packaging of the single-stranded positive strand DNA into phage products. So this is how the DNA gets replicated, gets amplified, and then ultimately gets packaged as a positive strand into the phage product. So how do we do replication of linear DNA? And we mentioned this, I guess, in one of the earlier meetings that we had. What's the fundamental problem in replicating linear DNA? I'll give you a hint. It has to do with focus up. How do you replicate linear DNA? So if you have one race, is that all you need? You got a polymerase, you got a primer. You got a primer, you got a polymerase. You replicate and go down, and you do the next one. So what's missing? Not the first half, but
whatever.
Well, with the primer right at the end. That's right. That RNA there. When that RNA goes away, you can't go backwards and fill in the gap. So you got a gap with the RNA primer. That's a fundamental problem for replicating linear DNA. Well, here are a couple of ways that those problems have been solved by bacteriophages. Well, one of them is done by T7. What T7 has is a genome which is what we call terminally redundant. And all that means is that it has a little bit of extra DNA at the ends, which are repeats of themselves. So when DNA replication starts with T7, it starts at an origin and goes bidirectional. And what you get is replication in both directions here, and the products of this replication are shown here. And if you just follow through the arrows, what you're going to see is as you put in your trailing, your lagging strand and the leading strand, you'll end up with these two molecules, which have 3' overhangs, reflecting the fact that the polymerase can't go backwards and fill in those gaps. So what does the phage do with these two different kinds of molecules? You have these 3' overhangs, which are homologous to each other, right? Because of the terminally redundant ends. So these molecules can base pair as a result of the 3' overhangs. So what you get is the generation of what we call concatenomers. And concatenomers are just long molecules of repeating regions. So if you look at this and say you have 100 copies of these kinds of molecules in a mixture in a bacterial cell, relatively high concentrations, the ends will find themselves. And you'll make molecules that contain two three, four, five, six, seven, eight, et cetera, long concatemers of repeats of base B7 DNA. So this is a way that they can hook up in ligands and get these long concatemeric molecules. Oh, before I get to that, so what happens with those concatemeric molecules is that they can get packaged into the phage head. So as the phage head has molecules on them in the tail region, it will recognize sequences on the phage DNA that will allow it to package the DNA in so that you cut it at certain points so that you regenerate molecules that look like this, with terminal repeats on it. So that you get complete copies of the genome packaged into the phage T7U1. So it fills in the end, basically, by those overhangs. Phage T4 does things a little bit differently. So it has specific origins, and you get bidirectional initiation of bidirectional replication of DNA. And you get strain invasion into the different molecules so that you can generate replication forks here. And this is what we call replication-dependent, or recombination-dependent replication that allows it to synthesize complete linear molecules in the DNA. This depends on recombination and strain invasion for completing replication of the molecules. And for phage T4, it also packages DNA in a head-fold fashion, but it's a little bit different in that it will cut only in head-fold sizes. So it can start at B, and then it'll cut at B, but slightly bigger. The head-fold is slightly bigger than the actual genome size of the phage. So what the phage gets is the genome plus something extra. So if you think of it that way, it doesn't matter whether it cuts at D and ends at C, or it cuts at G and ends at H, it's still getting a complete A to Z genome complement, plus a little bit extra. So these molecules will be terminally redundant, but permuted. So the ends aren't going to be the same. But it has a full complement of genes from A to Z. So that's the important point here. They're just making long molecules again and cutting them, not at specific sites, but whenever the phage sees it's got a full head of DNA. And the full head is a little bit larger than the full complement of genes that it requires. So it contains the full complement of genes plus a little bit of extra DNA. So this is how we replicate the DNA. The DNA gets assembled into the phage particles. You get either extrusion of the phage progeny or lysis of the bacteria that releases the phage particles. This last point here, the lysosome of the lysins, this is kind of interesting because there's a really very competitive field of biotechnology now, which is striving to capitalize and exploit these phage products as antimicrobial compounds. So if there are ways that bacteriophages can lyse bacteria, why can't we use that ourselves? So it all gets back to some of the earliest works done on bacteriophages that attempted to use bacteriophages as antimicrobial compounds that predated the discovery of antibiotics by 30 years or 20 years. People tried to use phages to cure disease. Now it's getting a little bit more sophisticated in that people are trying to use these phage products to lyse bacteria. And some of them are very effective, at least in animal models, at treating superficial as well as systemic infections because these enzymes have evolved to lyse bacteria. And they can do that in animal models and infection as well. How many of you are familiar with bacteriophage black acid? Okay. This is kind of important if you want to understand how phage genetics is done. It's also important because it helps you understand how bacteriophage behave. And the assay itself is pretty straightforward and it's shown here. You have a phage lysate, you make elutions of that lysate, and you infect indicator or sensory strains of bacteria. You let the bacteriophage adsorb, and then you mix the infected cells with some what we call top agar or salt agar. And this agar is a slightly lower concentration than the base agar that you generally use. The reason for that is because we want to have some diffusion in the agar itself. We don't want things to be fixed in place. So this is poured upon an agar plate, a normal agar plate with a regular concentration of nutrient agar, and incubated. And from the initially infected bacteria in this tube, now you have spread out on the plate bacteria, some of which have been infected with phage and some of which aren't infected. So that's why you use dilutions of phage here, because these plants represent a single infection event from this initial absorption, replication of the phage in that single infected cell, lysis of the bacteria, and then spread to adjacent bacteria and animal. That's why the indicator cells that are used here are in vast excess to the actual number of phage, because we need the bacteria to start growing in the cup fiber so that after the first burst of that initially infected bacteria and release of phage, there'll be some sensitive bacteria around them to be infected, to propagate the infection, so that what we see here are plaques, which represent dead bacteria in that zone and bacteriophage in the middle of that. And each one of these plaques then represent singly initially infected bacteria, that has been amplified by subsequent infection of bacteria in the area. And you can use the plaque assay to measure the growth of bacteria. And this is shown here in this one-step multiplication curve for lytic T2. And what it shows is the various stages of development of the bacteria. So if you look at different time points of the infected cultures, the infected sensitive bacteria with bacteria, and then either treat the culture at different time points with chloroform, which will lyse the bacteria and release phage particles, or just look at supernatants. Spin down the bacteria and then just look at the supernatants and look at phage particles. This is what you see when you plot versus time the number of infectious particles. That is how many plaques you can get at. That's how you measure infected particles. So what you'll see is that there'll be an eclipse period early on, the first 10 or 12 minutes or so, where you don't get any infectious particles at. Whether you lyse the bacteria or whether you just look at supernatants, you don't see any infectious particles. And the reason for that is, think about the actual infectious stuff. What are the first stages of infection of the cell by the bacteriophage? Pardon? It binds to it. And after that, what happens? That all happens very rapidly. What can account for this 10 to 12 minute gap? It's replicating. It's replicating DNA. Maybe not even making phage heads yet. So if you lyse the cells at this point, you don't have any infectious particles, right? The phage hasn't gotten to that point yet where it's assembled those components with DNA in it. So then, as you start to see a little bit later on, some of those infectious particles are being made because if you lyse the cells with chloroform, you can start finding, you see the curve here, infectious particles. But if you look in the supernatant, you don't see any yet. Why is that? It hasn't finished yet, right? You're still assembling the particles, hang down to the point where the bacteriophage turned on the late genes to kill and lyse the cell. So that's why you have an intracellular accumulation period here. And then you start to see accumulation of the bacteriophage in the supernatant, as seen in this dotted line right here. So that's why you see an early period where there are no phage particles detectable in the eclipse period, and then you start to see accumulation of the phage particles inside the cell, but not yet in the supernatant. So that's your one-step multiplication. And the turbidity of the culture is going to reflect that to a certain extent. So you can see that after infection, at the zero time point, the bacteria continued to grow, turbidity increases. At the point of initial infection, there is a transient drop in turbidity, which just has to do with the reaction of the bacteria to the infection. And then the turbidity increases again until a point where the phage lyses the bacteria, and then turbidity drops. And at that point, if you're measuring extracellular phage, you'll see an increase in phage. So all of this makes sense, too, in terms of the physiology of the bacteria first. So we know now that bacteriophage lambda can go through this lytic cycle here. The lambda also goes through what we call lysogenic cycle. So let's concentrate on the prophage state, talk about bacteriophage lambda, but also remind you that there are other bacteriophages which can go lysogenic, such as bacteriophage mu and P1 also, so lysogenic phase. Now the difference between these is that lambda, when it goes lysogenic, recombines into a specific site in the chromosome. So we'll concentrate on that in the next few slides.
And Curious Dave's Mew, which I mentioned in the first lecture, is a lysogenic cave, but it doesn't have any particular preference for where it integrates into the chromosome when it goes lysogenic. It will go into random sites. It integrates randomly. And as a result of that, it can integrate into genes and then activate those genes. That's why it was called Mew, short for mutated. It's a mutated cave. P1 is unusual in that when it goes lysogenic, it doesn't integrate into the chromosome at all. The P1 phage circularizes and replicates as a plasmid. So this is not dependent on being integrated into the chromosome for its own replication. It replicates as a plasmid, and in the lysogenic state, at each cell division, the plasmid will be segregated into daughter cells, and that's how the lysogen is propagated. So again, we're going to focus on the mechanisms of lambda, lysogeny, and remind you and talk about specifically the concepts of repression and immunity. We're also going to talk about this in the context of zygotic induction, so you all know about repression and immunity, and it's dictated by a repressor protein, the C1 product in lambda. So the initial step of lambda infection is lambda goes in as a linear double-stranded DNA. It has sticky ends overhangs, 5' overhangs, which when the bacteriophage DNA goes into the cytoplasm of E. coli, will not find each other. It's an intramolecular annealing event, and ligation occurs to seal the double circle. So you get, and you end up with a double-stranded molecule, circular double-stranded molecule from the linear molecule. And that's the substrate shown here, going linear to circular, which will recombine by a site-specific recombination event in the bacterial chromosome to produce this lysogen. So this site-specific recombination is driven by phage-specific gene products, recombinations or integrases. It occurs at a specific site in the bacterial chromosome. And for our purposes, we can refer to the at VTT key sites or at E sites, defining the attachment site on the phage molecule and the attachment site on the bacterial chromosome. And it's a site-specific recombination. These sites are similar in the DNA sequence. It's recognized by the integrase protein. It's made by lambda, and that drives the recombination that we see here to produce essentially a hybrid molecule that contains the bacterial chromosome with phage lambda DNA integrated in it. Parenthetically, let me point out that if you look at the structure of the phage chromosome in the bacterial chromosome, it's not the same as the linear structure of the phage in the phage head. Is it? It's not. The reason is because when the phage comes in as a linear molecule and circularizes, it circularizes at the sticky ends. When it integrates into the host chromosome, it integrates through the fat sites. It's not the same site. So you get a permutation of the gene order. The gene order is the same, but it's not starting with A and going through R here. A starts, goes through J, and then it picks up on the other side. So it's circular, it's permuted in the gene order. So this is the panel model for site-specific recombination of lambda and the chromosome. And the way that this phage maintains its lysogenic state is by shutting off the vegetative gene so it doesn't replicate. But it's going to be in the host chromosome, it's not going to want to replicate itself. The bacterial host will do the replicating for it. The only phage gene then that's transcribed is the phage repressor gene, which keeps everything else shut in. And because the phage repressor is the fusible cytoplasmic protein, it can extend immunity to the host so that light phages, or lambda light phages coming in, will be repressed by the action of the repressor at the operator cell of the protein, exactly the same way that it represses the genome that's already integrated into the bacterial chromosome. So that's how repression works
and the whole concept of immunity is related to the synthesis of the C1 repressor protein. It blocks initiation of the enzyme. So how does this all work? Well, this is just an amplification of the genetic region, which is called the immunity region of Wnt. It has all the important players in the Wnt lysosome. The C1 repressor protein is synthesized through two different promoters, which are sequentially activated. The first promoter that we'll talk about is the CB promoter for establishment of lysogeny. This promoter drives transcription of the repressor in this way. The PM promoter is the promoter which will maintain lysogeny and maintain synthesis of C1. And this direction again is in the leftward direction. We'll talk about how these promoters are activating a little bit. The other important players are the operator promoter left, the operator promoter right. The operator promoter right will drive synthesis in the rightward direction by transcribing the protein, which is an anti-repressor, and the C2G, which is a positive regulator of lysogeny. In the leftward direction, you get synthesis of an anti-terminator, synthesis of another positive regulator of lysogeny. So these are all the elements which are involved in the initial decision of whether the bacteria is going to be lysogenic or not. And this is how the decision is made. So we're looking here at the regulatory genes and the late genes. This is what goes on upon early infection of E. coli with phage lambda. You get synthesis beginning by recognition of promoters left and right at the operator sites, and you get expression of the end gene, which allows transcription to continue in left ear direction. But more importantly, early on, you also get synthesis, you get expression of transcripts in the right ear direction from the PROR, the operator promoter right, and synthesis of PRO and C2. And these are the two important players in dictating whether you're going to get lysis or lysogeny. And the really important player is C2, which is relatively unstable, although it can be stabilized by synthesis of C2. That's getting a little bit more Byzantine in the explanation. I don't think we need to get down into those details. But the important thing to note is that in the lytic cycle, PRO is the molecule that occupies the operator sites, operator right and operator left. So PRO is known as the anti-repressor because of that. If PRO occupies these sites, then the phage repressor protein, C1, cannot occupy these sites. So the bacteriophage is committed to the lytic cycle when that happens. So PRO competes for the operator sites with C1. So where does C2 come in? C2 acts at this promoter for the initiation of synthesis of C1. Remember the PV site that I showed you on the previous slide? We talked about synthesis of the repressor comes from the PV to establish lysogeny. Then this promoter will shut down in the PM if they go. So the actor that's important at PV to establish repression is C2. If C2 can occupy this site and C1 repressor starts to get made, then the C1 repressor protein can compete with the CRO protein to occupy OL, the operator left, and OR, the operator right. If C1 can get to these sites before CRO does, then the phage is moving toward lysogeny. Because once CRO occupies these sites, it will repress synthesis in the rightward direction, and synthesis from the PR promoter dictates whether PRO is going to be made or not. So if C1 can get to the operator right, it will shut down synthesis of PRO. So PRO can no longer compete with these operators with C1. So it's driving the organism into lysogeny. Similarly, let's not forget about C2. The other thing C2 is doing, in addition to establishing lysogeny, is it is initiating transcription from this promoter to drive synthesis of the transcripts for the integrins, because that's the other step that the phage needs, and needs to integrate into the chromosome. So C2 dictates whether or not the integrase enzymes can be made so that the phage now can also recombine by the site-specific recombination. back to C1. Once C1 occupies these operator sites, it also will open up this other promoter, the PM promoter, the promoter for maintenance of transcription. So again, to go back to the structure in this region, here is PE. Pro dictates whether, I'm sorry, C2 dictates whether the PE is going to be activated and drive expression of the repressor. Once the repressor is made, it can bind to OR and OL. When it binds to OR, it has a dual effect. It has the effect of shutting down transcription in the rightward direction, so PRO doesn't get made. But it also opens up promoter M. So it acts as an activator in a sense, that it opens up this promoter so that it drives expression of C1. In this way, you can think of C1 as being autoregulated, because its presence at this site activates and amplifies its own expression from this promoter. Now you might think of, look at this and say, well, now that C1 is occupying the operator right and shutting off expression of the anti-repressor, what about PRO? PRO's not being made anymore either, is it? Right? I'm sorry, not PRO. PRO's not being made, but C2's not being made either. And that's okay, because C2's done its job. Once a repression is established and maintained, PRO's not being made, so you don't need C2 anymore either. So this is how isogeny is activated and how it's maintained through expression from PM. And this is just another slide that shows you the autoregulatory cycle of the C1 repressor protein. It is synthesized as a monomer, the monomer for dimers. And this is something you should all keep in mind too. Many, many, many examples of bacterial regulatory proteins act as dimers. And they have domains which specifically recognize DNA sequences and domains which specifically dictate their interactions with each other. So if you look at lambda and you understand how lambda repressor protein works, you'll understand this as a model for a lot of other proteins, which are DNA binding proteins that regulate gene expression. So the dimers associate, or the monomers associated with dimers, they bind to the operator right, operator left, and as you see here, they open up the promoter site for maintenance of transcription of the C1 repressor gene, as it's shown here. This slide shows how the cycle is reversed. How do you induce a lysogen? How do you induce a lambda lysogen? Lambda doesn't want to stay in a host, which is unhealthy, so it is wired into the SOS response of the bacteria and can sense DNA damage, which may cause the bacteria to die. And the way that it senses the DNA damage is that it's hooked into the SOS response of the bacteria that recognizes single-stranded DNA, and the single-stranded DNA will lead to activation of REC-A. Remember this from the earlier discussion we had about the SOS regulon. The REC-A is activated and becomes a protease which will cleave the repressor. In cleaving the repressor protein can no longer bind to these operator sites, operator left or operator right. And in the absence of the repressor at this promoter, guess what's going to get synthesized? Transcripts in the rightward direction, which include PRO. When PRO gets made, PRO can then occupy the operator right and left sites and drive expression of the phage into the lytic site. And some of those genes which will be expressed as a result of activation of this operator left will be the genes necessary to excise the bacteriophage genome from the chromosome. This is what we see here with the integrase gene in conjunction with an excision gene that leads to the reversal of the Campbell model and release of the bacteriophage from the chromosome. So this is how phage lambda is induced to come out of the chromosome. And a final point then is that this gets back to the concept of transduction and this specialized transduction which can occur where bacteriophage lambda as a lysogen is induced out of the host but undergoes an abnormal crossover event. So that the crossover doesn't occur at the normal crossover site to release an intact copy of the phage, and restore the intact chromosome of the host. But if the crossover occurred outside of that region, you'll end up with defective phage particles that have lost parts of the phage chromosome because it was left behind as a result of the aberrant crossover. But in return, it picked up some segments of the bacterial host chromosome. And these are now phage particles that are specialized translucent particles because they contain covalently linked to the phage DNA, parts of the bacterial host DNA. So I just want to leave you with that as a wrap-up to the discussion on bacteriophage genetics. Link it a little bit back to specialized transduction, the whole concept of DNA transfer by transduction. Do you have any questions about the material that we've discussed today? I'll send you a short bibliography about both gene transfer as well as the bacteriophage genetics so that you can have some other things to look at if you'd like. Look at the suggested readings in the chapters in your book as well, because they are good readings in terms of looking back at the original papers that describe some of these concepts so that you get a better feel for how things were interpreted and how they came up with the different models. Think about how science is done. Looking at some of these older papers will give you a better sense for that experimental design. Always good to learn from some of the giants in the field. So don't ignore those bibliographies either. Okay, so next week we'll talk about mobile genetic elements, a little bit about evolution, talk a little bit about transposons as well. If you have any questions, come see me or email. And I'll try to think things out there. Okay? Thank you.